Thank you. May it please the court, I'm going to change the course of this argument for as long as you allow me, but I'm willing to come back to those same points because, unbelievably, they may not all have been covered sufficiently. I wouldn't have thought that beforehand. Yeah. With all this briefing and all this discussion, there still may be some, so I welcome those questions. I think it's critically important to step back from this for a moment and follow the sequence of events. I know that the court's very familiar with the briefs. What happened here is that in April of 2004, my defendant, Dr. Pitt, a Missouri resident and employee of Columbia Surgical Group, took a trocar, a device a little bit larger than this pen, placed it into the abdomen of the plaintiff in a place that would be a normal place to do it. However, it went into the liver because it happened to be adhered that day. The point is, he placed this trocar into the liver. He allowed the gas to go into that, believing he was in the right place when he was not. If you saw this instrument, I almost brought it to court. Any plaintiff's lawyer that's brought any of these cases, much less a sophisticated plaintiff's firm like this one, has seen these dozens of times. It's a little bigger than this. It has a ball on the end of it, and the valve is the same thing that the doctor holds on to place that trocar in, also has the valve that he switches to turn the CO2 on. So it is inconceivable to me that they could possibly believe that anybody other than he would place it or would turn the CO2 on. And in those instances where doctors do allow or do need assistance to have something else injected into the patient, they must always order it. Everybody knows that. So what we're dealing with here is a situation factually, where nobody but this doctor, my defendant, controls where to put that, where nobody but this doctor, my defendant, controls when to turn on the gas, and he physically turns it on himself in this instant. And what happened here is it went into the bloodstream, directly up into the heart, from the heart up into the brain, caused a brain damage, and the plaintiff is brain damaged. That's it. That's what this case is.
So and you're saying there are no issues as failure to recognize and address after surgery was completed?
Correct. The brain damage was instantaneous. It had, by the time this process was recognized,
so
it was
done.
So
your real point is that there's no supervision possible.
Precisely. It is physically impossible for anybody to have supervised the damage that occurred, the event and the damage that occurred. It was that quick. Once the gas was on, it was out of the bag, and literally into her circulatory system.
And I believe it would be your position that it's not the hospital or the hospital system role to develop a standard for this because the profession itself, this surgeon's profession, has the standard for how you place this and what you do with it.
Correct. And there's zero allegation that that's ever occurred. And, you know, she says, well, I was unable to find any laparoscopy procedure that the told surgeons where to put these. Of course she has it. In all the hundreds of thousands anyway, of cases that this plaintiff's firm has performed and performed extremely well, they've never found an instance like that because it just isn't done, and they know it. And remember, the test is what
the test has really been specifically discussed. We've been talking about good faith.
The test is would the facts support a reasonable opinion that a case could be made? And that's not fantasy. That's not what if. So let me go to the second.
The other part of it is that there's not an allegation, I assume, that the hospital or the hospital system was wrong to admit this doctor to privileges for doing this procedure.
Correct. That was
in
one
this
of my,
hospital.
You're ahead of me. There's one of my 5 points later, Your Honor, and that is that absolutely there is no claim of negligent referral or negligent staff privileges. Nothing like that. Nothing even approaching that. Nor is there any factual basis for it. If that matters, I realize it doesn't for this purpose. Now they filed the first lawsuit in October of that year, 2004, against Dr. Pitt and his group. And I stress that because whatever thought you might have about, oh well, is he employed or what could he, you know, maybe the hospital was wrecking what he did. They knew he had Columbia Surgical Associates Inc. and they knew that he was their employee, and they alleged it from the get-go. So even at the first filing, and we're actually talking about the second filing, even at the first filing, they knew facts that would completely negate the idea that either Boone or BJC controlled Dr. Pitt and what he did with this surgery and placing the gas in. They already knew it. So it's no longer reasonable for them to believe this maybe kind of should've, would've type situation. Now, after that first filing, there was a motion about venue filed, and in the course of that, affidavits were filed clarifying even more so that Dr. Pitt is not an employee, was not an employee, acted entirely on his own, for better or for worse, etc. All of this is in the knowledge base of the plaintiffs when, and their counsel, when in 2006 they filed the First Amendment petition, which is what this venue review is about.
You know, perhaps it would help if you would explain explicitly the relationship between Dr. Pitt, his group, and the hospitals, okay, and how they get paid.
Dr. Pitt is an employee of Columbia Surgical. He gets paid by billing his patients for his surgery that he performs there. His relationship with Columbia Surgical is he is on their staff.
And where is Columbia Surgical located?
I'm sorry, his relationship with Boone is he is on their staff.
And where is Columbia Surgical located?
It's located in the medical building by the hospital.
But your opponent says that the hospital paid Dr. Pitt. Under what relationship?
It's the first time I've heard it, and I don't know what she's talking about. But to the degree, and by the way, in fairness, it's possible she knows of something I don't. I inherited this case after the fact. But it's not in any...
Do we know where the patient's check goes and what check actually comes to Dr. Pitt?
The patient would be paying Dr. Pitt's surgical group, not the hospital, if that's what I'm saying.
That's why I'm at. I mean, the money doesn't go to the hospital. The money goes directly to the surgical group, and then he gets a salary from them, gets no money whatsoever from the hospital.
If he does, it has nothing to do with this kind of practice. I've never heard of him getting money from the hospital, but if he does, it has nothing to do with this event, this patient, this day. This was a private patient. He's on staff.
What other facilities were Columbia Surgical located in a building and next adjoining to the Boone County Hospital? What other places would they do their surgery?
There's only, I think, two places in Columbia to do the surgery. Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Right. Which presents an interesting problem, because if both of those happen to affiliate with the St. Louis entity, then all of a sudden, if you're going to practice in that town, you're all of a sudden going to be dragged into St. Louis under the current way the plaintiff looks at it. So I think that's his issue, too, in terms of addressing what's wrong, which is saying, well, if they call this an integrated delivery system, everything happens in St. Louis, but it really doesn't, and it leaves all the rural.
But isn't that up to BJC and their affiliates, and if they're going to hold themselves out to the public as being part of this St. Louis-based system, you know, they can quit doing that. But if they're going to do that, they should be responsible for it.
It is up to them. However, it doesn't, if you're Dr. Pitt, you don't have a choice. You've only got two places to practice if you're going to practice in Columbia. And he's not holding himself out as any of those things.
But if you could address that, go back to that other side of the question. Have they done that? Have they alleged sufficient affiliation here that, I mean, and maybe that's his only choice, is he's going to have, if in fact he chooses to practice that sort of medicine in Columbia, if in fact it was part of the same corporation as BJC, that would certainly be the case.
They alleged no affiliation. What they alleged was, in the first one, they said, oh, well, Dr. Pitt and his corporation were somehow controlled by BJC. That's silent in the second one. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Because they knew better by then. They had learned the facts. They knew he wasn't controlled by either of those entities, so you don't see it.
Now, when we say that, are there no requirements of surgeons practicing at Boone County as to what they can or cannot do by the hospital?
I'm sure, I'm not sure what you mean. Staff privileges allow you to do certain procedures and not others. Is that what you mean?
Right. And what I'm saying is, isn't there an inherent idea of control that if you're going to operate in my hospital, you're doing it this way?
No, sir. Staff privileges have never, in this state or anywhere else that I know of, been used as a basis for holding the hospital liable.
So if there is an injury that results from a doctor's action, the hospital would never be vicariously liable for that doctor unless the hospital also did something else wrong.
Is correct. That correct? Unless he employed the doctor, which they clearly did not.
Incorrect.
Unless the doctor had such a bad record, and these cases have been brought around the country, that they never should have credentialed him, or they should have taken his credentials away, taken away his staff privileges. Those are the two ways.
But hospitals have no duty regarding independent doctors performing within their walls.
They have no duty and no capacity to control it, and it would...
Presumably they could provide it to...
There was some contract, wasn't there, between Boone County and the Columbia Surgical? I mean, wasn't there some basis of a contractual arrangement by which he gets surgery, and whether they pay him or pay Columbia Surgical, he's getting paid through the hospital?
If you're talking about if somebody's using a collection service or whatever, I don't know, but there's no contract that gives gives Boone or BJC any power or control over how he does his surgery, which is the issue here. I'm sorry.
I presume the hospital could be liable if they provided a non-sterile environment in which to perform the surgery, or they were affirmatively negligent on their own. You're simply saying there's no vicarious liability.
Correct. Yeah, there's no vicarious. If they could be affirmatively negligent, except they weren't, and there was no indication of that in this case. Well, my time is dwindling, and I still haven't managed to change the court's focus. But as you know, from being so familiar with the briefs, and despite my ineptitude at refocusing the court, I do want to point out that I have raised in particular, and the others have also supported it.
You have not been inept. In fact, it's been an excellent argument. And Judge and Ms. Lockwood, I know your father's here, and your first argument in Supreme Court, you've done an excellent job, but you're still continuing on that. But still, you have not been inept.
So you have a minute and 30 seconds. What's your other argument? Yeah.
We've raised the fact that the statute regarding venue changed in between the two filings. And so as of the second filing, the one this is about, the statute about venue had come into place the year before the tort reform statute.
And since your time is so short,
sure.
you appear to be arguing on that issue that if you bring the action against a new party, you have brought a new cause of action.
Correct. And that's consistent with what this court has found as well.
Yeah, but the cause of action was not the issue in Linthicum. It was the issue of when the suit was brought, not whether you brought a new cause of action.
Yes, except if you turn around and place the cause of action analysis into Linthicum, you find that the first claim, the first suit that was brought that matters, there were some that were dismissed, the first suit that matters that was brought was against the right operator. Then the second suit, the amendment came later, suing his employer and two previous owners of the wheel. So that adds new defendants.
But as I know, you cite Burns in your brief. The
yes.
issue under that is whether it arises out of the same operative facts. And they all arose out of the operative facts of this operation.
I would simply beg to differ that it cannot, because, and if you look at the amended petition, as this court pointed out in Burns, the operative facts mean the operative facts of negligence, not the operative facts of the event, i.e. the injury or the death. That's what Burns was about and said so, and said it made it very clear. So when you look at the operative facts of negligence, they joined Dr. Martin, and on count three, they listed three pages of independent acts by Dr. Martin. So that's a new defendant with new acts that only he can commit.
Well, didn't Burns actually say it doesn't matter if you changed from survival to wrongful death or whatever, that it was the same facts of the person's injury there? So it arose out of the same incident.
Yes, because Burns said you look at the tortious acts or negligence, you don't look at the result. And what I'm saying is they've pled new tortious acts against a new defendant. So even under Burns, this is a new cause of action if you use that type of analysis. As far as file versus brought, I'm over time, but I cited two cases where the Southern District and the Eastern District use those words interchangeably. So,
gave you a whole 2 3/4 minutes. Ms. Lockwood.
May it please the court. I just want to address briefly what Mr. Baldwin stated regarding the liability in this case. If you look at both our petition and our first amended petition, it alleges a failure to properly take a history from Ms. Kumar in the emergency department, a failure to timely detect the source of her persistent abdominal pain and discomfort, a failure to refer or consult with a surgeon in a timely manner.
Do you allege any of those related to the injury? As I understand opposing counsel, he's saying it's clear the injury just occurred from inserting the instrument incorrectly and was not related to any of those other allegations.
That is not true. Dr. Draben, who is actually a BJC Wash U physician who is now at University of Pennsylvania, has been deposed in this case. And he has an issue with the hospital consultation that was obtained, the surgical consultation obtained with Dr. Pitt, the timeliness of it.
And that related somehow to the injury, though?
It does relate somehow to the injury, because we allege that if this had been timely diagnosed, she had an ulcer. If it had been timely diagnosed on day one, day two, day three, day four, they could have treated it appropriately, and maybe they wouldn't have had to have this surgery where they inserted the trocar. Now, when the jury hears about this, I imagine they're going to mostly focus on the insufflation of her liver with carbon dioxide gas that went into a circulatory system and caused the brain injury. But the jury is also going to hear from Dr. Draven that there are issues with the failing to timely consult a surgeon, the failure to timely detect. One of the reasons I'm going to put that into evidence is because what this woman had was an abdominal ulcer, not something that should have resulted.
The need for it was a piece of damage, was an item of damage. The need to go for surgery itself was an item of her damage because she wouldn't have needed it, you would allege.
If it had been properly treated, the ulcer had been properly treated, and they'd got that surgeon in there earlier, or they'd gotten an appropriate consult in earlier, or as we've alleged, they performed an endoscopy in the emergency room. That is a specific allegation in our petition, the failure to perform an endoscopy in the emergency room. An endoscopy is going to show an ulcer. You can treat an ulcer. The reason that Dr. Pitt did this surgery was because they thought something else was going on.
Your experience is that the ulcer should have been treated with antibiotics rather than surgery.
Perhaps it could have been treated with antibiotics. There are different ways to treat it. But when they went in for the laparoscopy in mid-May after two admissions to the hospital, they were probably thinking they were going to find something more significant than an ulcer. So that's why our petition encompasses a much greater scope than simply the insertion of the trocar into this woman's liver.
And is there anything, again, connecting what Boone did or didn't do in that regard to BJC?
Yes, I believe that there is. And what I would direct the court's attention to is my response in this court to the original application for writ transfer. In that, I attached my response to Boone's motion for summary judgment. And that's marked as Exhibit A1 through 41 in this record. But it's a little bit hard to find because it's, again, attached in my response.
What was it again?
Suggestions and opposition attachments.
Yes.
What was it again? What was the site?
It's cited. It's an attachment to both my response to BJC and CHLI Services. Writ app in this case.
It's A1, in the 42 exhibits.
A1 through 41. It's not in the 42 exhibits.
Okay, thank you.
It's not in the bound volume. It's stapled as plaintiff's
additional
material.
And what is in there?
What is in that is my response to Boone Hospital's motion for summary judgment at the trial court level. Uh-huh. And that's going to lead some insight into what my good faith belief was. They say that how could I have a good faith belief that Boone was involved when this is a surgery case? One, it's not simply a surgery case. Boone Hospital and BJC employed the scrub technician, a scrub technician in training, the circulating nurse, a physician assistant. Actually, the physician assistant was employed by Columbia Regional, and the anesthesia personnel for the operating room. They chose those. Dr. Pitt testified over objection that he had control over the carbon dioxide gas. So the defense lawyers in this case were saying, objection, we don't want him to answer that question about did he have control over turning on that device that started the flow of the CO2. We deny that Pitt had sole control over it. Pitt testified that the surgical nurse or the physician's assistant may have pushed the button on the insufflator to start the flow of gas. And so when we filed this petition, particularly with a scrub technician in training in the operating room at the time, did we have a good faith belief that one of those entities might have turned on the CO2? Because it's unbelievable to me or even a layperson that a surgeon with any experience is going to put CO2 in a woman's circulatory system during a laparoscopy. This is an outpatient procedure, typically an outpatient procedure that takes less than an hour to do. And so my good faith belief was real. It was valid given all of the facts of this horrific event that occurred. It's not simply, hey, he did this and it was a mistake. That's their defense in the underlying medical negligence claim. And I've got something to say about all of that, not just me, but through the expert testimony from the three retained experts that I've hired. Boone Hospital provided these scrub techs, they provided the circulating nurse, they provided the anesthesia personnel, the operating room, and Boone Hospital and its nurses obtained the informed consent for the surgery. They never told the plaintiff or Dr. Hader that one of the possibilities was CO2 embolus. That's not on the consent form. Boone Hospital completed that consent form. The evidence in the case is that Pitt and Columbia Surgical had nothing to do with getting the completing that form, which is on a BJC Boone logo. In this case, I have alleged in the petition and the first amended petition that informed consent is an issue. So that is a specific allegation in one of the A through N components. Again, it's A through N. Those are all of the various allegations of negligence, not just the surgery done. The plaintiff was billed by Boone Hospital for the trocar that was used. So there is evidence in my response to Boone's motion for summary judgment that the plaintiffs paid the hospital for the trocar. All of the surgical equipment, the monitors, the instruments, the supplies, were billed to the plaintiffs by Boone.
So the patient never paid the surgical, Columbia Surgical, anything?
They did. They would have paid him for the surgical services and for the physician assistant that was present. So they would have billed for the time for those two.
Are you alleging there's a defect in the surgical instrument?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No. There is an issue that Dr. Draben brought up about the technique that was used, and you would have used a different instrument, a different instrument.
But you're not alleging negligence technique by Boone, except perhaps into the, are you alleging that as to the consent?
Absolutely as to the consent, absolutely as to the emergency room physicians, mm-hmm. absolutely as to failure to perform an endoscopy and to more timely treat and diagnose this condition.
And those are employees of Boone in the
yes.
emergency room?
Yes.
And Dr. Draven's at the University of Pennsylvania?
He is. I do want to address the argument that the amended petition where Dr. Martin and Columbia Nephrology were joined somehow allows application of the new venue statute that came into effect in 2005. And the timeline is important here. The medical negligence, of course, occurred in May of 04. The cause of action was filed October of 04. The new statute comes into effect 8/28/05, although it's passed in March of 05. May 3rd of 06 is when the amended petition is filed. September 20th of 07 is when those defendants are dismissed, and this is what's not in the brief that's important. October 30th of 07, the venue motion is argued. February and March of 08 is when the trial court issues its orders denying venue. So at the denying the motion to transfer venue. So at the time that the venue motion was argued and ruled upon, defendant Martin and Columbia Nephrology were not in the case. So this is what distinguishes the case from Lithicum. The cause of action was filed back in October of 2004. Simply adding a defendant whose conduct stems from the same set of operative facts does not constitute the filing of a new cause of action. As is defined in the House bill. There was never a dismissal of the cause of action. There was never a refiling of that cause of action. The case just continues. And because of that, the pre-August 2005 venue rules did apply and do apply in the case. The House bill clearly says that it only applies to causes of action filed after August 28th of 05. The only claim that was filed after August 28th was against Dr. Martin, and he was only in the case for 16 months before the venue motion was ruled upon. If you look at one of the statutes in the House bill, it's 508.012, it attempts to codify the Lithicum opinion by saying, at any time prior to the commencement of a trial, if a defendant is either added or removed from a petition filed in any court, which would have, if originally added or removed to the initial petition, altered the determination of venue, then the case should be transferred to an appropriate venue under 508.010. Here, the addition of Dr. Martin did not alter the determination of venue. And that's exactly what the Lithicum case was addressing as well, that two-step where the plaintiff joined an out-of-state defendant and filed an amended petition 2 days later. The addition of Dr. Martin was not to manipulate the venue statute. The addition of Dr. Martin was to preserve the statute of limitations against him. We wanted to take his deposition to make sure he wasn't specifically involved. He was dismissed 16 months later without payment after we had the opportunity to take that deposition. So Lithicum, as you pointed out, and as this court knows, involved interpretation of a statute that's not at issue. The issue here is, by adding a defendant, do we somehow get under the new venue laws? And the answer under the case law, under the way this court has interpreted cause of action, is simply no. We're under the not-for-profit venue statute that was in effect in 2004 when this cause of action was filed. It's never been a disputed fact that BJC has its principal place of business in the city of St. Louis. And that is what venue is premised upon, the not-for-profit venue statute that was in effect when this cause of action was filed. The defendants are trying to create an exception to the plain and ordinary meaning of the statute, or an exception to when its application should be triggered, and it just does not exist. Even 508.010 subsection 9 of the new venue statute says that in all actions, venue should be determined as of the date the plaintiff was first injured. The plaintiff was first injured in May of 2004 before House Bill 393. The new venue provision under the House bill that discusses transfer of a case based on the addition or removal of a defendant, 508.012, focuses on whether the addition or dismissal of that defendant would have altered the venue determination in the first place. It would not have done so here. If I had joined Dr. Martin and his group in May of 2004, it would not have altered the venue determination. And that's a very important point that perhaps I think was glossed over in the briefing of each party. And I'd be remiss not to mention the section 538.304, where the legislature clearly states that the provision of this act, including the venue provisions, shall apply to all causes of action filed after August 28, 2005. This cause of action, under this court's analysis in Burns and the prior case law defining cause of action, was filed in October of 2004. And with 6 seconds left, I'll end my argument.
Did I understand you correctly to say that you're making an allegation in here on failure to obtain informed consent, and the informed consent that was obtained was on a BCJ form?
Yes, BJC form. Yes, Your Honor.
Was that a standard form that said all the consents you needed, all the things you needed to consent to for this type of surgery, or was it particularized, prepared by this doctor? Do we know who?
Yes, we do. We know that Dr. Pitt did not complete the form. We know that a nurse at Boone Hospital filled in the form. So it's a form where
the procedure is filled in,
and BJC's on the.
But it wasn't BJC form language. It was a BJC logo at the top, and then the nurse or someone at the hospital, at Boone Hospital, filled in the particular information. BJC didn't direct Boone of the information they had to tell the patient.
The form is a Boone BJC form, and what the nurse filled in, I believe, is the type of procedure that was being done.
Is there evidence that BJC directed Boone what things they had to put in their consent form?
That I'm not sure of.
Did they provide the form? Did BJC provide the form?
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All All right. May it please the court, I will try to respond to several bullet points that I think are certainly something the court needs to be aware of, and most of them are factual. First off, we just heard some discussion about supposedly maybe the nurse turned on the gas because she couldn't believe the doctor would turn on the gas or be in the wrong place. Well, all we can go by for her good faith belief in this petition is the amended petition, which states literally on page 8, Pitt and Columbia Surgical Associates negligently performed a laparoscopy on plaintiff Kadar, at which time defendant Pitt punctured plaintiff's liver with a blind trocar insertion, introduced carbon dioxide through this puncture, and caused and allowed this gas to come into plaintiff's circulatory system. So her good faith belief was this was all done by Dr. Pitt, because that is how it's always done, and these plaintiff's lawyers know that. There's no allegation in here that a nurse put gas in the patient. Second, there's no allegation, well, I've already covered that. Third, I'm hearing things about liability for a hospital's informed consent form. The form has never been a basis that I know of ever for any hospital ever being held liable. There's no claim, by the way, against BJC that they had a defective informed consent form or anything like it. I've never seen liability on the basis of an informed consent form. It is always the duty of the healthcare provider, usually a surgeon, to talk about the risks and so forth and get it signed. Otherwise, they're committing a battery.
Well, what's concerning me here is if we're looking at venue, mm-hmm. is there a direct participation by BCG in this specific operation? Why isn't the use of their standard form, if it says that on the top of it, direct participation and control of what will be in at least the informed consent?
Anytime you're on staff of a hospital, you're going to use that hospital's form. Now, if that hospital happens to be affiliated with another hospital, you may use that hospital's form.
Well, yeah. I mean, is it so simple as that's a connection?
It's so simple that it's a connection of you're going to use that hospital's form because you are on the staff.
Do you mean form like stationery, or does the form have information?
It's form like stationery, but okay. The fact is,
It has pre-printed. I agree that this.
And we know about these, and then the doctor fills in the rest of it. But none of which has anything to do with what's alleged here. There's no allegation.
Well, it's exactly what's going on here. That's a form this patient signed.
I should be clear. There's no allegation that the informed consent.
That there's anything wrong with it. The printed form. But if there is allegation that it did not complete the information for the consent, isn't that an action by BCG that's at issue in this case?
Well, number one, they didn't sue BJC for a defective informed consent form, and number two. Yeah, a defective informed consent form didn't kill this patient. I mean, everybody's going to go to that. Brain damage this patient.
Yeah, but that's a whole. That's a separate cause of action, whether or not she was warned.
But there must always be a connection to the damage item. You must connect it to causing the damage. And there's
just so we can clarify, because it seems like we're talking about different things. The form. Did it have standardized language on it, which was then signed, or did it just say consent form? And then it says, I consent, these are the following things I have to be warned about, blank, and then that was all filled in locally, or did BJC fill in some of the information?
No, that's all filled in locally, so you're clear, it's a pre-printed form, like people can go to the stationery store, if there is one still, and buy deed forms if they don't want to use a lawyer and fill in the data. It's the same type of thing.
Yeah, but the deed form has in, and I give to you, and I make these warrants and promises. Were there things like that filled in by BJC?
Nothing filled in, but it's pre-printed to say, I understand there are these risks.
Is it in the record?
Yes.
The document's in the record.
But it's a pre-printed document. It doesn't just say informed consent. It's not just a piece of stationery, mm-hmm. if that's what you're asking, Judge. But there's no allegation of that somehow controlled what happened here, and that's my point.
Well, is there an allegation that they didn't warn about the risk of the CO2 injury, and if it listed the risks and did not list that, wasn't that an allegation against?
I should clarify. It's not. It's a general form for surgery. It's not specific to the surgery. It's always up to the healthcare provider, the surgeon, to make it specific to the surgery.
To list the specific risks of that surgery.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Or your honor. Thank you.
The case is submitted.